Everybody for joining this morning. I want to thank the Bayit for their willingness to host this class in person. I do hope that later this year we will actually be able to have sessions in person once again. As well, I want to thank Shari Shamayim for co-sponsoring the series on various legal ethics topics. This one is Shepherding Jewish Families Through Family Law Litigation. I do want to make note of the fact that my Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, offers these sessions for free, but everyone is more than happy to accept contributions to the Beit Midrash. In the follow-up email from today's session, I will note that as well. We do give tax receipts for end-of-year gifts. I also want to note, 2 weeks from today, Sunday, December 26th, we have a free all-day program on a Tanakh tour of the land of Israel, 11 30-minute classes on different places in Israel and their role and resonance in Tanakh. I'll send out the flyer for that afterwards as well. It should be a fun program. There will be an in-person option as well as an online option. Our next legal ethics program is going to be in the beginning of March. We usually put in November, December for everyone trying to get their credit and then take a break for a couple of months for classes for the doctors instead. But we'll be back, God willing, on Monday evening, March 7th with ethical competition for clients. So 7:30 p.m. Monday, March 7th, and I'll, email the legal ethics email list with information for that as it gets near. Okay, this session is accredited by the Law Society of Ontario for 1.5 professionalism hours. Please make sure, as I said before, that you sign in. Just send me a message in the chat with your name. That's sufficient. If you didn't get email from me about this session, then include your email address. God willing, in the next week or two, we will send out the credit certificates. So, please make sure that you sign in. I am not recording video. I'm only recording audio. So you can't say, well, look at the video and you'll see me there. That doesn't work. Finally, thank you to the family law practitioners who sent me ideas for this session. I'm going to try to give, thoughts on a range of topics from within the ideas that were submitted and beyond. Please note, though, that practical halachic rulings reside with your rabbi. I'm not trying to give anybody practical advice, neither in legal advice and neither in halachic advice. This session is dedicated by Jesse and Deborah Kaplan in honor of the yahrzeit of their grandfather, Rabbi Philip Kaplan, Zichrono Livracha, Rav Pesach Ben Chana, who I was privileged to know well, and really a great man. And I now want to invite Jeremy Sirtash to speak about his father, John Sirtash, Zichrono Livracha. In my first year in Toronto, John sent me his paper on the get law, and he sat with me to explain the concept and its practical application, something that we're actually going to be talking about during the session. I followed up with him at the time by telling him about a case that I had heard of, about a woman who was being refused a get. And he took it on himself to look into it. He became involved trying to help. And in ensuing years, he was in touch with me about additional ideas for programs, always trying to bring together Jewish law and Canadian law, Ontario law, with an eye toward increasing people's knowledge and helping those who need assistance. He would attend seminars on legal ethics and other topics, and he followed up with thoughts afterward on the issues discussed, and he would send me relevant articles of interest from time to time. And it was really a shock when he passed away several months ago. And as I said, I've asked Jeremy to please share with us a few words about his father, Zichrono Livracha. I'm putting the link in the chat again for the source sheet. Someone told me that they were having trouble with that. But I'm going to spotlight Jeremy here and turn the floor over to him.
Good morning, everybody, and good morning, Rabbi. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak this morning. I just wanted to share a few brief thoughts about my father, John Timor Sirtash. He came to Canada in 1957 as a four-year-old. As a refugee from Hungary. He was a child of Holocaust survivors. survivors. He became a lawyer in 1979, obtaining his law degree from Queen's University. In the 1980s, he became a Bali Chuba. Somebody really took an interest in the renewal of Judaism, you know, especially as a child of Holocaust survivors, to be able to raise his kids with a Jewish education. I was sent to Jewish school. My sister Alana was sent to Jewish school. My brother Joshua was sent to Jewish school. All because he loved Judaism. He loved Torah. He loved knowledge. As a lawyer in the early 1990s, he spearheaded, and I'm sure Rabbi Toshino will speak a little bit more about this, but he spearheaded essentially what he saw was problems for Jewish women and also mothers who were unable to obtain a religious divorce, and they were known as hakunot, and because they wouldn't, under Jewish law, and even under Shia Muslim law, you need the man to acquiesce to a religious divorce. And I was a baby at the time, but from what my father told me over the years, this really troubled him. And he really was determined to find a way to, how can we find a Canadian solution to this? And what he did was, he actually got many communities together to amend the Canada Divorce Act, which is the governing legislation in Canada about divorces, to get Parliament to amend it to allow individuals who were unable to obtain divorces, allow different ways for the law to allow them to obtain the divorces. So, for example, under some of the amendments, if there's a refusal to give a get, there can be procedural things in family law that prevent them from moving forward until they acquiesce to a religious divorce. Now, the reason I say this is unique with Canadian is because what my father did was he got, with his kippa, he wore his kippa very proud. He met with the Archdiocese of the Catholic Church here in Toronto. He went around getting momentum, meeting with Muslim leaders, Shiite leaders, Sunni leaders. And even though the Catholic Church wasn't involved too much in this because it was more a Jewish Muslim issue, he did this because he said, and my father told me, when he would go to Parliament to try to get this legislation passed, he wanted to show Parliament that this isn't just a Jewish community effort. This is, I'm really here speaking on behalf of all religious faiths here in Canada. And that's one of the main reasons that this law got passed in the early 90s, because when the parliamentarians asked him, as I said, why are you doing this? He says, I'm doing this on behalf of all the religious faiths here in Canada. And since the early 90s when the law was passed, I believe he's helped over 25,000 women across Canada obtain divorces. Now, obviously under Jewish law, and the rabbi can speak more to this, you can't force someone to give a divorce, or else it's not halakhically permissible. But these amendments to the Canada Divorce Act were passed and were actually halakhically allowable because it didn't force a man to give a religious divorce. What it did was it created the circumstances that would enable them to free many of these women who were chained to their religious divorces. I just want to go back to just briefly talk about why I say that these amendments and what my father did was unique to Canadian. And he was very proud of that because in 2005 he was invited to a Knesset committee in Israel to see if they can do some type of, they can learn a little bit from the Canadian legislation. But of course in Israel it's very political there and it didn't go anywhere. There were some discussions my father told me about bringing this type of law to some states in the United States, but as we all know, you know, with the greater separation between church and state in the United States, it was kind of a hands-off. We don't really want to go that way. So just to end off, I'm very proud of the legacy that my father left. You know, we all do our best. We all strive to leave a legacy after we pass away. But I truly believe that even though my father's no longer here, the amendments and the efforts that he made to get this law passed has helped so many women and will continue to help women for generations to come. And the last thing I want to mention is I'm not a family law lawyer. I'm a civil litigator. and continue to maintain in my practice, and something I wanted to share with everybody. So thank you very much, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak this morning. I really appreciate it. And thank you for the things that you shared with me when we spoke over the summer as well, you know, about your father as a human being. Some of what you got into at the end there, I really appreciate that as well. Okay, so our topic, and I am going to come back to the get law as part of it, but our topic in general is shepherding Jewish families through family law litigation. Our professionalism topic is topic 2.4. It's at the top of the source sheet. I'm going to put the link in the chat once again for the source sheet. The topic is recognizing and being sensitive to clients' circumstances, special needs, and intellectual capacity, e.g. multicultural, language, gender, socioeconomic status, and demeanor. And we're, our focus here is being aware of issues that are specific to the Jewish community. Somebody emailed me in advance of the session saying, you know, you really need to talk about, it should be, there should be a focus on the need for the lawyer to provide emotional support for the client. And that's certainly true. We actually discussed this in a session not that long ago. I think it was in the beginning of COVID. We had a session on supporting the emotionally unstable client and some of the challenges that can come up in terms of the emotional relationship with the client. But that is definitely, definitely true. But what we're going to be looking at are issues that relate specifically to the challenges of dealing with Jewish clients in family law. So I gave you a series of vignettes on the sheet, five vignettes. There is no way we're getting to all five. I know we're not getting to all five. Maybe we'll have a part two next year because there are even topics that I wanted to address that didn't make the five that are here. But we're going to get through as many of them as we can. I would wager probably we'll get through three. That's what I'm thinking. If we can get to the fourth, I'll be very happy with that. But I want to make sure that we address each of our topics properly. Each of them, I think, is important. So the first topic is the topic of religious divorce and get refusal. So I'm going to read the first vignette aloud. After 10 tumultuous years of marriage, Abe and Sarah both wish to divorce. They have a parenting plan for their 7-year-old son, Jonathan, but they're having difficulty negotiating the division of property. Sarah is happy with the law. Abe, on the other hand, would prefer to work with the Jewish law system for dividing property, which would assign him more of their assets. Abe insists that he will withhold a get, bill of religious divorce, until Sarah complies regarding division of property. And unfortunately, this is not rare. Does Jewish law allow Abe to do this? What can Sarah do about this? That's our opening question. So I'm going to launch right in here on the topic because there's a lot to be said, certainly, about it, and I think that it's in the best interests of getting through some of these vignettes if I launch right in on this one. So does Abe have the right to refuse to give a get? Well, as Jeremy noted before, in halacha, marriage is a contract between two parties. And as with any other contract, one party cannot compel the other party to leave the marriage, to leave the contract. There is no option for unilateral breaking of that contract. That's true in terms of the man. The man has to be willing to participate. And it's true in terms of the woman. The woman has to be willing to participate. For the man, that's biblical. For the woman, that's rabbinic. And a great topic for another discussion. But the point is that if I just stop there, you can make the argument that we can't force the man. A man may refuse to give a get because he entered into this agreement with her. And there's no reason to force him out of the agreement with her. However, giving a get is also a mitzvah in certain circumstances. And if you take a look on the source sheet, you'll see that I listed some examples of it. This is, as I noted there, a non-comprehensive list. It's source number one on the source sheet. In the event that he is physically abusive, it is a mitzvah for him to give a get. All of these, by the way, are sourced in the Shulchan Aruch Eben HaEzer. in the code of Jewish law. I did not start listing them on the sheet, listing the sources. As it is, the sheet's pretty long. But number one, if he's physically abusive, yes, there is a mitzvah for him to give a get. If he is not supporting his wife financially, in terms of food, in terms of clothing, also mitzvah to give a get. If he's not sleeping with her on the basis that is established in Jewish law, there is a requirement that he should be sleeping with her. This is called ona. And again, if he's not meeting that, then also he is required to give a get. He has a mitzvah to give a get. When I say mitzvah, I should be clear. Mitzvah does not mean good deed. Mitzvah means there is a halachic imperative for him to divorce her. If he has become physically repellent, if she is refusing marital relations, I noted there either partner, that's also grounds for it. And key for our discussion, if the relationship has already broken to the point where he wants to end the relationship, as seen in a case where he wants a civil divorce, but he's not willing to give a get, then there is a halachic requirement for him to give the get. And in any case where he has this mitzvah of divorcing, he's not allowed to refuse to do so. So if Abe has already established that he wants to divorce her, as is our case, he's not allowed to withhold a get. There's actually a lot of discussion about what exactly that means when he wants to divorce her. At what point do you deem the marriage over? So one thing that I'm going to note for you now that you'll see later on, I produced the first version of this source sheet late Thursday night, and I sent out the link for it, and I didn't change it. So anybody who downloaded the sheet with the link I put in the chat now got the same as anybody who downloaded the sheet Friday morning. However, as often happens, subsequently I saw more sources that I wanted to include. So I've created a second version of the source sheet, and when I send out the follow-up email from this session, hopefully tonight, I'm going to include a link for the new version, which will give you a few added sources, including a source for an article that appeared in the journal Tradition in 1997. In which Rabbi Michael Broyd on one side and Rabbi Chaim Malinowitz on the other side debated, among other things, at what point we say the marriage is over such that the man is obligated to proceed with the get. But it's very clear that in a case like ours, where he intends the civil divorce, he is halachically required to give the get. And I'll give you a quote from Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who was probably the leading authority in Jewish law in North America until Rabbi Moshe Feinstein came over from Russia in the middle of the 20th century. He said the following: if a husband and wife separate and he no longer desires to remain married to her and she desires to be divorced from him, in such a case, divorce is a mitzvah and commanded by Jewish law. One who withholds a Jewish divorce because he desires money for no just cause is a thief. Indeed, he is worse than a thief, as his conduct violates a sub-prohibition related to taking a human life. He was very clear about this, and that's also going to be on the updated source sheet that I'm going to send out, I hope, later today. On the basis of that, we also have a ruling in the year 2016 by Rav David Lau, Ashkenazi chief rabbi in Israel. You see it on your sheet as source number two, from an article on the news website Srugim, Drama in the Rabbinical Court, a precedent-setting ruling of Rabbi Lau. I'm going to read out my English translation, and in general, I'm always going to be reading out my English translations, although you have original Hebrew on the sheet as well. In a decision given by the Chief Rabbinical Court, headed by the Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi of Israel, Rabbi David Lau, the Rabbinical Court established that one may not condition or link the division of property to the presentation of the get, and obligated the husband to give the get immediately and to set at another time a hearing in the Rabbinical Court regarding division of property. So it's very clear, in answer to our question, that if there's intent to divorce, then he's not allowed to hold up the get. That's all well and good, but what can Sarah do about it? We now know that Abe is in violation of Jewish law. What options are on the table for Sarah? So I'm skipping the whole history of how recalcitrant husbands have been dealt with historically, in order to focus on contemporary practical steps. If you want to know more about how they were handled historically, it's a great discussion. There's a lot of material on this, but it's not our topic for right now. So first of all, and I think very important to know about, even though Abe and Sarah can't do this at this stage in the marriage, family law practitioners should understand halachic prenuptial agreements, which have been extremely successful in eliminating cases of aguna before they can start. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 3, this comes from an article by Rabbi Shlomo Weissman in 2012. Rabbi Weissman is the director of the Beth Din of America, which is the Beth Din of the Rabbinical Council of America. The article is entitled Ending the Aguna Problem as We Know It. Rabbi Weissman, incidentally, is also married to a Toronto girl, and when it's not COVID, visits here, and he's a great Talmud Chacham. So, in this article in which he describes the RCA's prenuptial agreement, which by now has been in use for decades, he says, "What is most remarkable about the prenup is that it actually works. It has been utilized in scores of cases before the Beth Din of America, and has consistently prevented the use of the get as a tool for improper leverage or extortion. It has worked dramatically to produce a get even in highly contentious cases where couples have bitterly litigated all the other issues on the table. Most often, where there has been a prenup in place, the Beth Din has not even needed to begin formal proceedings to award support under the arbitration provisions of the agreement." I'll come back to the arbitration provisions in a little bit. "The mere existence of the prenup and the husband's knowledge that it is an enforceable document has convinced the husband that he has nothing to gain by delaying the delivery of the get." And the truth of the matter is that I've heard over the years the claim that there has never been a case of aguna in a case where the couple had this prenuptial agreement. I once asked Rabbi Weissman why he didn't mention that in the article. But it's the sort of thing which you don't want to say, because if you say it, you know what's going to happen next. Someone is going to just have to defy you. But I think that the statistic is still true. And the way that the prenup works essentially is that it has two parts. One part, what you're trying to do, first of all, as Jeremy noted before, is to avoid creating a coerced get while creating a binding commitment to divorce. So you have two parts to this. And the first part, which is really important, is a commitment to attend a particular Beit Din if the relationship falls apart. That's number one. We're going to talk in a little bit about whether this can be done in Canada. It's a good question. Hang in there. But the first part of the prenup simply says, we agree that if something goes bad, we are going to go to such and such a Beth Din. So if you take a look at source number 4 on your sheet, you'll see it there. Key clauses of the Rabbinical Council of America prenuptial agreement. The full text is at theprenup.org. Arbitration. Should a dispute arise between the parties so that they do not live together as husband and wife, they agree to submit to binding arbitration before the Beth Din of America, which shall have exclusive jurisdiction to decide all issues relating to a get, ketubah, tnayim, any issues and obligations arising from or in connection with this agreement, any disputes relating to the enforceability, formation, conscionability, validity of this agreement. So, as family lawyers on this talk will know, where you have problems in Canada is that the Beth Din cannot get involved in dealing with those other issues that relate to the divorce, division of property, and so on. They will not be able to handle that. But in terms of handling the get, handling the religious divorce, saying that we'll go to this Beth Din for the get, that should be valid here as well. This clause is not controversial in Judaism, by the way. I brought you in source number 5 from Moshe Feinstein, who was the leading authority in Jewish law in North America until he passed away in 1986, taking over from Rabbi Henkin in the 50s. And you see in his responsum here, which is from 1980, he was asked whether to add the following language to the Tnaim document. The Tnaim document is a document that husband and wife agree to when they're at the engagement stage, or today it's often done at the wedding itself. It's actually a document which says that both families don't have any outstanding financial issues between them to obstruct the marriage, and they wanted to add the following language. Should they separate after marriage, God forbid, the husband would not delay giving a get, and the wife would not refuse to accept it when so instructed by Rabbinical Court X. You name whichever rabbinical court. Because of this addition, the secular courts would compel them to listen to the rabbinical court. So he says, one may add this. You can do that. And the get would not be considered coerced. It would also help save her from the chains of igun. And then he says, it will be good to see the groom and bride and know them well, to know if there is concern due to their nature that such a condition could cause strife and quarrels. He wants to be really careful about bringing up divorce with people who are just getting married. But fundamentally, he says, this is fine. Now, again, Canada has a particular issue here, which limits what a Beth Din can actually do. If you take a look at source number 6 on your sheet from the Ontario website on family arbitration, faith-based family arbitration, Ontario law allows you to talk to a religious official or someone knowledgeable in your religion to help resolve a family dispute. Ontario says you can talk to a rabbi to help with your family disputes. Thank you, Ontario. However, if an award is made based on religious principles, the award would not be a valid family arbitration award under the law. Both spouses could comply with the award voluntarily, but the award would not be enforceable if one of the people involved took it to court. The court can only enforce arbitration following Canadian law. A religious official can conduct a family arbitration under Ontario law if they completed the required training and follow the law on arbitration. The arbitration would be enforceable like any other arbitration. So in other words, if the Beth Din is going to get involved in custody issues, if the Beth Din is going to get involved in financial issues and decide things based on Jewish law, then no, Ontario is not going to consider this enforceable. However, one could, first of all, they can go to a Beth Din if they're going to agree to follow whatever the Beth Din decides on their own. It's just like any other time where a couple divorces and come up with their own system for handling matters. But I also want to note that this doesn't stop the couple from identifying the Beth Din for religious matters, specifically for the divorce. And so in source number 7 on your sheet, I gave you a link. Rabbi Michael Whitman of Montreal came up with a halachic prenuptial agreement for Canada. And what he did was simply take this idea of identifying the rabbinical court and only identifying it for the purposes of handling divorce, which should be, it would seem, fine in Canada. That's the first part of a prenup. The second part of the prenup is, going back to source number 4, the support obligation, as it's called here. And what it means is that the husband accepts that he will pay his wife a certain amount of money per day if they're no longer living together, but there is no get. That's what it says. You can see it there for yourself in source number 4. I'm not going to read it out loud in the interests of time. This is an old practice. This is a very old practice. We have in the 13th century in Spain, the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, in source number 8, talking about this being done as a post-nuptial agreement. Not prenuptial in that case, but postnuptial. Reuven, Leah's husband, agreed with Leah's relatives for Reuven to divorce his wife Leah. They agreed upon a fine of 1,000 dinar for non-compliance. So he agreed. He's going to divorce her. Leah's relatives say, look, pal, this marriage is over. Give her a get. He agrees. There's even a fine if he doesn't divorce her by a preset time. Later, Reuven recanted and refused. So they, Leah's relatives, are warning Reuven of the fine. So Reuven has gone to the custodian, pleading with him to compromise. He doesn't accept the plan of his wife's relatives. Just the opposite. They have now threatened that if even an hour passes after the deadline, they will jail him until he pays. Due to this fear, he is divorcing. But he is not expert, such that he would know to give a declaration that this is being done against his will. That's a whole other topic I'm not getting into right now, the declaration. But the question is this a coerced get because he's doing it under threat of a financial penalty or jail? And Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet answered, no, This is not called a coerced get. He agreed to make this payment on his own, and it's fine. There are other cases that I could bring on this that I'm not going to right now, but if you look at source number 9, I gave you links to 3 classes I've taught about prenuptial agreements, and I give more of the history there. But basically, this is not called coerced, but rather the payment is either viewed as support for the wife, just like a man is obligated to support his wife all through the marriage. So this is the sum that he is giving to support her, you know, until such time as there is a religious divorce. It happens to be $150 per day indexed to the consumer price index. Or alternatively, this is a payment like damages because he is keeping her from marrying somebody else and getting support from the new husband. So this is an agreement that he enters into. Again, it's in a prenuptial agreement here, in which he says, if we're no longer living together, but there's no get, then here's what I'm going to give you as payment, either as a support payment or because I'm keeping you from marrying somebody else. I'm told that this is the part of the prenuptial agreement which doesn't work in Canada, although I have to admit that I'm not clear on why it shouldn't work. This isn't a family law proceeding. Is anybody familiar with why this part of the prenup should not work in Canada? I don't see why this should be a problem. In other words, this isn't a family law proceeding. This is simply a statement of, in the event that that there's no religious divorce, I agree to pay her a certain amount of money per day. You're not resolving issues based on religious principles. I don't really see why this shouldn't work. I want to look into it further. But I don't see why it should be a problem. And I'm not hearing any explanation. So, family law lawyers should also be aware that this can be done as a postnuptial agreement as well. It could even be suggested to couples pro forma, meaning the same way that people now prepare end-of-life care documents when they're in good health. So maybe it should also be suggested to couples whenever it is that a lawyer has the opportunity that a married couple should execute a postnuptial agreement. I think it could be helpful. But now let's get back to Abe and Sarah, because Sarah's waiting for her get. We have now established that when Abe has decided the marriage is over, he's not interested in proceeding, he has a mitzvah of divorcing her. They didn't have a prenup. They didn't have a postnup. So what happens now? So now we come back to the get law. And you can find this online in an online legal databases. You could find in source number 11 the article that I'm going to quote there, celebrating the success of Canada's get legislation and its possible impact on Israel, which is available online. Basically, what the get law says is in source number 10 on your sheet from the Divorce Act, where a spouse who has been served with an affidavit under subsection 2. Which was the one that said that, which asks him to certify that there are no religious obstacles to divorce. So if he has been served with such an affidavit, and he does not, within 15 days after that affidavit is filed with the court, or within such longer period as the court allows, serve on the deponent and file with the court an affidavit indicating that all of the barriers referred to have been removed. So if he doesn't, if the husband does not say within 15 days, I've given the get, and satisfy the court in any additional matter, the court may require that all the barriers have been removed. If he doesn't do that, the court may, subject to any terms that the court considers appropriate, dismiss any application filed by that spouse under this act, and strike out any other pleadings and affidavits filed by that spouse under this act. He loses his voice in court. That's what will happen until such time as he actually provides the religious divorce. This is not called a get meusa, a coerced get, because nothing is being taken away from him. He just can't respond to things in court. It does raise certain questions about resorting to civil authorities and civil courts, secular courts, I should say, not civil, it's family law, but secular courts, But those can be resolved, and we're going to come back to some of them later on, I hope. But this has been, according to the article that I brought you in source number 11, extremely effective. The 1986, this is from John's article, the 1986 provincial Ontario and 1990 federal Canadian legislation has substantially reduced the problem of the agunar and dramatically facilitated the obtaining of a get for both men and women in a very timely manner, often less than 30 days. According to Rabbi Mordechai Ox of the Toronto Beit Din for Divorce, the official responsible for administering more than half the gittin in Canada, there has been an 85% drop in the incidence of get abuse and manipulation of the get as a tool of blackmail by recalcitrant spouses since the legislation came into force. And you can keep on going there, and you see a quote from Montreal as well. Now, I have to note, this isn't complete for two reasons. The number one, it isn't complete because of, unfortunately I'm aware of a case like this, because of the fact that where the husband has no claim to make in court, he has no assets for her to receive. He's broke. He's not working. And there are no children that he's worried about seeing. So he can say, so I won't have any claims in court. If the only satisfaction I'm going to get in life is to hurt her, you can't force me with this to give a get. He's willing to suffer the consequences. So this is not 100% effective because of that. That's number one. Number two, realistically, there is always going to be the fear of social stigma. You went to the secular system in order to be able to compel the husband to give a get, and there are women who don't feel comfortable making use of this recourse, even though it is at their disposal. So this hasn't solved all the aguna problems in Canada. Nonetheless, testimony of an 85% drop in the incidence of get abuse is a remarkable achievement, and I think one that should be noted. What happens if this isn't working? So I wanted to just make note of an organization, which is based in the U.S., but I know they have done things in Canada as well. It's called ORA. You can see in source number 12 a letter from Rav Gedaliah Dov Schwartz, Alav HaShalom, and Rabbi Shmuel First, Yibadal HaChaim, in support of this organization. The Organization for the Resolution of Agunot is an outstanding nonprofit organization which resolves aguna cases within the confines of halacha and civil law. ORA is the only nonprofit organization addressing the aguna crisis around the world on a case-by-case basis. At least that was true in 2011. I don't know of another organization that's doing it today. They have assisted the resolution of over 165 aguna cases, including a number of cases from our own community. They were in Chicago. We have worked with them and fully support their efforts to bring these women from darkness to light, from captivity to freedom. They get involved in public activism, where a husband is refusing to give a get. The question of how far to go, how to do it, when to do it is a good one beyond the scope of this shiur. But that's basically what my answer is to vignette number one. Number one is if Abe has decided he wants to divorce her, then he has a halachic obligation to give a get. This could have been taken care of if they had a prenup or a postnup, as we've described here. And in the event that he's refusing, you have in Canada the get law, which can be extremely helpful in that regard. And if that fails, then you have this organization, which has had success mobilizing communities in order to encourage divorce. They're not acting on their own, I should stress. They act, ORA acts under the guidance of Rav Herschel Schechter, my Rebbe, and as I said, they've had success in that regard. I'm gonna pause now for questions. Nope, it's all clear? Yes, Gary. You're muted. Gary, you're muted. Right, I'm not going to be able to hear you. Sorry. Michael, you were going to say?
I don't have a question, but I just wanted to let people know that there is an organization here in Ontario as well, whose main purpose is to help agunas, and if you want further information, feel free to contact me. Rabbi, I'll send you the information.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Gary, you were going to say? Oh, wait, now you muted yourself again. Waiting on you, Gary. Gary, you're muted. I'm sorry.
You can hear me now?
Yes, now I hear you.
Excellent. I apologize. With regards to support, is $150 a day flexible, or is that set?
So it's indexed to the consumer price index, which means it's going to vary as prices for goods go up. We just had articles in the news last week about how food is going to go up in cost next year. So the consumer price index will reflect that, and that number will go up. That number was, for all I know, it's changed anyway, you know, since the time that I pulled that off of the website. I pulled that off of the website a few years ago. But they can use any number that they want within reason. And I say within reason because what you want to avoid is the classification of the payment as a pure fine or penalty. That's what you want to avoid. If you do that, you can claim coercion. Whereas if it's an extension of the normal obligation of support, then there's no argument. At that point, it's okay. That's the difference. Okay. Mark, I saw your hand and then Tilda. And then I see Miriam's hand without the electronic hand. Yes, Mark.
Does the post-op have any efficacy when the husband is both very rich and very vindictive?
So does the post-op have an effect when the husband is very rich and very vindictive? So I think it has the same effect as it did before. There's no reason why it wouldn't. But if you're in a relationship with a vindictive man, then you really are going to have, then you really are going to have, issues no matter what. In other words, anytime you're dealing with a dangerous person, you're going to have issues that you're going to have to deal with both from a Jewish perspective and from a secular perspective. This isn't going to make the husband behave any better, if that's what you're asking. I see a note in the chat, but
I mean, the financial part isn't a disincentive. He can keep on paying forever. He just doesn't want to stop her from getting married again.
Correct. No, as I said before, this doesn't solve 100% of cases. If the husband has the wealth to be able to keep on paying her and just wants to make her miserable, again, if there are children involved, that may change his calculus. If he wants a relationship with them. But it's true. This doesn't stop everybody, and that may be where an organization like ORA can be helpful. Yes, Tilda. You have to unmute. There you go.
Yeah. Hi. I'm circling back to that question you asked about whether fines would, in fact, encourage people to give a get when there's a financial penalty. So I only question that because I did do that in a case from a superior court. And when the base team found out that there was a penalty every day, they considered that to be indirect coercion, and had great difficulty with allowing the male to give consent voluntarily in light of the fact that they knew of this court order, then he had to pay a penalty. So perhaps you could tell me whether or not there's a sort of, would there be an attitudinal change or something that we can use in order to allow for this sort of indirect type of enforcement, because otherwise, we're not left with a lot of tools, notwithstanding the amendment to the Divorce Act, because at the end of the day, sometimes there's what I've seen, a reluctance from the judiciary in order to not allow someone to participate in a case, notwithstanding the amendment.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's practically a bit of a ledge that we have when we're using this amendment in order to ensure someone's on an even playing field.
Right. I hear that. I mean, in terms of the judiciary's discomfort of making use of this, that I can't speak to. I have no knowledge or experience of it. In terms of the Bethdin, so I have not asked Rabbi Ox or any of the judges involved in the Toronto Bethdin about their comfort with this. I have the quote that John brought in his article from Rabbi Ox suggesting that he was good with it. It is true that where the payment is cast as a penalty, you are going to be vulnerable to the argument that this is coercion, as opposed to where it's cast as support, because support is an obligation all through the marriage. That's not new in this circumstance, and already Rav Avraham Yeshaya Karel, it's the Chazon Ish, one of the leading halachic authorities of the 20th century, he was based in Israel, made it very clear that where a husband divorces in order to get out of paying support, that is not considered coercion at all. And that's the basis for casting it as support, is I have Rabbi Karel, it's the Chazon Ish, on my side. You know, there are those who don't like prenuptial agreements, but the RCA's prenuptial agreement has passed the test with numerous leading rabbinic figures, and that's why I feel comfortable with it. And you know, when I was in the shul rabbinate business, I would expect couples who I marry to have a prenup. I considered that to be you know, necessary. I just there's a question someone sent me in the chat that I want to address, although really I prefer the questions to be allowed, please, if at all possible. What if the wife works and the husband does not work? Who is responsible for payments? And the answer is that from a halachic perspective, the man's obligation to support his wife exists even if she is working. So it doesn't prevent that. There is discussion about what if the woman says, I don't want your support, I just want to keep my income for myself. There's a lot of discussion about that, but speaking broadly, her working does not eliminate the duty to support. The other question, this is why I don't like questions in the chat, because it becomes hard to scroll and see them. Does he have to pay even if he does not have money and children involved? If you'd have those prenup or postnup, then absolutely, that doesn't change anything. Miriam, and then Yechiel.
So I want to understand, going back to the point that the halacha says there's a mitzvah, a commandment for him to give her the get in the certain situations, why we need to go outside our Jewish system, and why there isn't recourse in halacha, in hashkafa, in what the rabbis can do for us, just like they can do things like a pros bowl, and they can do things like you know, smechirat karkaot. Why is there no? Why do we have to at all go into the secular world to solve this terrible problem?
So you're asking a really good question, for which I would refer you to the classes I've given on the prenup for more discussion of it, because I didn't want to turn this whole session into being about this, but in brief, the examples that you bring of rabbinic workarounds are consistently about dealing with rabbinic law in the first place, meaning the pros bowl doesn't work when Shemitah is biblical. It only works when Shemitah is rabbinic. Heter Mechira also only works when you're dealing with rabbinic Shemitah, not when you're dealing with biblical Shemitah. There is a limit. You know, I think it was Blue Greenberg who famously said, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. Unfortunately, that's just not true. It's just not so. But there's more to be said about this and the ins and outs of what can be done, and I would recommend catching those recordings. I didn't expect to use this year as that. There's just too much other material we have to get to. Yechiel.
Thank you, Rabbi. I think it's important, especially in the light of the situation that Tilda raised a few moments ago, dealing with the problem of get, Mahusa, forced get.
Yeah.
Do the amendments to the Family Law Act and the Divorce Act, removing the barriers to religious remarriage, do they, in essence, have the potential of causing a get, Mahusa? And they do. But there is a solution, a very easy solution. And I've written about this a number of articles years ago. Before you bring a motion, so I'm speaking to my colleagues, the family law lawyers here, before you bring a motion to invoke those sections, please, please, please go to a knowledgeable rabbi, describe your situation, and then get it in writing that you can bring the motion.
Mm-hmm.
That way, you and your client are protected from any arguments post-get. Oh, it was a get, but it doesn't count in the official standards.
Right. This is a very good point. Thank you, Yechiel. I was going to mention that later when dealing with division of property, but it's worth mentioning now as well. If you can get rabbinic license in writing first, your client will be much better off. And you want to go to a rabbi who knows the topic, knows the field, and whose word will be respected. So thank you for mentioning that. I appreciate it.
I would just like to add just two little points there. And in that area, in my own personal experience, years ago, I went to a Rav Miller Shlita, and he gave me permission. I said, Rav, could you please send that to me in writing? He said, oh, I don't have time. So I wrote him a confirming email, and I said, if I've got this anyway wrong, please write me back. And so we were okay, that got resolved. But, and also, second point, Rabbi, if I may. We've had a lot of talk here so far about the male, the husband, being the recalcitrant one. I haven't heard anything yet about the wife being the recalcitrant one, just as the husband must give the get willingly.
Right.
So too must the wife receive it. And I was involved in a case with Edwin Flack many years ago where the wife was refusing to receive the get.
Right.
So I was wondering if you had any insights on that.
It's certainly true. As I noted before, the get won't be valid if the wife refuses it as well. And I also am familiar with cases in which the woman refused to receive the get. When I was a shul rabbi in the U.S., I dealt with two such cases in which the wife was the one who was refusing the get. It certainly happens, not with the same frequency, but it exists. There are versions of the prenup that are designed to deal with both spouses being recalcitrant, as opposed to the RCA's language, which is really husband specific. But I have seen them deal with the present language which could be applied for either spouse. I believe the Israeli version called Heskem Kavod Hadadi, the agreement for mutual respect, I believe does that, for example. It's true. It exists. It's not the majority of cases, but it definitely exists, and it's worth knowing about. Okay. Vignette number two, alternative dispute resolution. So going back to the beginning of the source sheet, we have the following case. We're still dealing with Abe and Sarah. Abe and Sarah are going to be with us throughout. Abe executes a get, but insists that he wants to work with the halachic system for dividing property, as we already noted in vignette one. He thinks that'll favor him. When Sarah proposes arbitration, Abe claims that Jewish law will not permit him to accept an arbitrator's decision if it is not based on Jewish law. He says, an arbitrator is going to tell me to do something that's based on some other system. I can't accept that. Is Abe right in his objection? So, as a general rule, it's important to know that Jewish law is very much in favor of alternative dispute resolution. We had a session on this in 2019. I gave you a link for it in source number 13 on the sheet, Legal Ethics, Sue or Settle, and you could listen to an hour and a half on this topic at that link. Ontario loves settlement outside of family law. Before we get to family law, I gave you a reference in a case from 2013 in source number 14, which explains the goal of settlement in the Ontario system. Settlement, actually in Canada. Settlements allow parties to reach a mutually acceptable resolution to their dispute without prolonging the personal and public expense and time involved in litigation. The benefits of settlement were summarized by Callahan in Sparling v. Southam. The courts consistently favor the settlement of lawsuits in general. To put it another way, there is an overriding public interest in favor of settlement. This policy promotes the interests of litigants generally, by saving them the expense of trial of disputed issues, and it reduces the strain upon an already overburdened provincial court system. So that beginning in the 1970s, you had pre-trial meetings with the judge or with another judge. I saw that called designated hitter mediation. Interesting. And then you have in the rules of civil procedure, I know that's not family law, but it's more general, in source number 15, we have Rule 50. The purpose of this rule is to provide an opportunity for any or all of the issues in a proceeding to be settled without a hearing. and with respect to any issues that are not settled, to obtain from the court orders or directions to assist in the just, most expeditious, and least expensive disposition of the proceeding, including orders or directions to ensure that any hearing proceeds in an orderly and efficient manner. And then I also brought you from the Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 24.1 in Source 16. This rule provides for mandatory mediation in specified actions in order to reduce cost and delay in litigation and facilitate the early and fair resolution of disputes. Now, the Law Society, in its Rules of Professional Conduct, in Source number 17, stresses, a lawyer shall advise and encourage the client to compromise or settle a dispute whenever it is possible to do so on a reasonable basis. Reasonable basis meaning, I asked Marvin Huberman about this, and he said, when it's in the best interest of the client, and shall discourage the client from commencing or continuing useless legal proceedings. Useless legal proceedings meaning, you know, a proceeding that's without merit, a delay tactic which doesn't have merit in its own right. This comes out in family law as well. I didn't bring it on this version of the sheet, but it will be on the version that I'll send out, God willing, tonight. In Ontario's family law rules, Rule 8.1 speaks about a mandatory information program that the parties are required to participate in. So I'm reading out from Rule 8.1 about this mandatory information program. The program referred to in this rule shall provide parties to cases referred to in Subrule 1 with information about separation and the legal process, and may include information on topics such as the options available for resolving differences, including alternatives to going to court. You want them to be aware of where you can resolve this without a lawsuit. Jewish law, switching gears, loves settlement. And this is a very important point. If you look at source number 18, there's a passage in the Talmud which discusses what is called in the Talmud either pshara or bitsua. Literally, pshara means balancing, and bitsua is splitting. Both of them refer to a kind of settlement which is basically arbitration. You go to the rabbinical court and lay out the sides, and the rabbinical court tells you, okay, we're offering this as a solution. It's not mediation. It's really arbitration. And in that context, you find three different views in this Talmudic passage. The first view, Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Yossi of Galil, says, no, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to engage in this kind of arbitration. It's a violation of justice. Justice should pierce the mountain. That's his argument. However, as you continue in the source, Rabbi Yeshua, son of Karcha, said no. It is a mitzvah to try to arbitrate this case and to come up with some kind of a settlement. And he quotes you biblical verses I'm going to come back to in a moment. And then third, Rabbi Shimon, son of Manasseh, says, well, it depends. He says, If the judge has heard the sides and doesn't yet know which way the law would go, then the judge can impose this arbitration. However, in the event that you know what the law should be, that's a different story. Then at that point, you can't violate justice. So there's a lot to be said about this. And in the class on suing and settling, we talked about this at length. But in practice, we say that in a rabbinical court, the court is supposed to pursue arbitration. And this is brought by Maimonides in the Sanhedrin 22:4. It's brought by the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, Choshen Mishpat 12, for a variety of reasons, which I listed for you in 19. Number one, social peace. You're supposed to pursue peace. If you look back at source number 18, one of the verses Rabbi Yoshua, son of Karcha, quoted, truth and justice of peace you shall judge in your gates. We want to pursue peace. Second, there's concern. If you insist on doing this as law, what if the judges make a mistake? We'd rather not get into that. We'd rather come up with a settlement that everybody agrees to. Number three, concern that justice is sometimes too harsh for the needs of the parties involved. Number four, there's a concern that if you come to a just conclusion based on the letter of the law, controversy between the parties will still continue. Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin was the one to point that out. If you come up with a settlement, it can work. And then finally, you have the view of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, in which he says, if you look at the verses that I underlined in source number 18 in the English there, the two verses that are brought to promote trying to come up with an arbitrated solution, the one verse talks about emet u'mishpat shalom, truth and justice of peace. The other one says that King David performed justice and tzedakah, righteousness. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, the goal of justice is peace. That's what you see in the first verse. Justice and justice of peace. Emet u'mishpat shalom. That's number one. Number two, in the second verse you see that we're supposed to perform justice which brings about righteousness. So Rabbi Soloveitchik argued, and I brought it for you in source number 20, that the true goal of the Jewish justice system is to achieve a verdict which is going to bring about peace and which is going to bring about righteousness. It's not about saying so-and-so has the right to claim all the money or not. And so based on that, he said, that's why we look for an arbitrated settlement. We would prefer to have the peaceful result that brings about righteousness. That's what we're looking for. So I see your hand, Gary. Hang in there. Give me 1 second. Stay where you are. Because we value settlement, you know, it's really, really important that any proceedings be handled, first of all, hopefully, with therapy before litigation. I'm not a therapist any more than I'm a lawyer, which is to say I'm neither. But any time there's an opportunity to try to resolve things, you know, first outside of litigation, that should be tried. Number two, the parties have to be able to approach each other with validation and empathy. They have to find a way. And obviously there are cases where that doesn't work. I'm not talking about abuse. But you need to try to approach the other with a level of empathy in order to retain an atmosphere which is going to allow for settlement. And certainly they shouldn't be disparaging the other party. If you disparage the other party, you're closing the door to any sort of settlement. And again, I'm not talking about an abuse case. I'm talking about cases that are open to this kind of treatment of one for the other. Yes, Gary.
Rabbi, I didn't understand the use of the word split in the context of 18. Like, in English, that means, you know, to separate and what have you.
I raced through that. I really raced through that piece. What it means is to split the sum of money that's under dispute so that you don't simply say so-and-so has the right to 100% of the funds, but you come up with something that leaves each of them with something. I should note, Rabbi Schachter, in explaining Rabbi Soloveitchik's position, said sometimes the settlement that we're talking about is 100-0. Like, that can happen. Don't assume that because I said splitting, that means that everybody has to come away with some money. It's not necessarily so. But the point for us is that some level of saying, yeah, I could see how under the law maybe I would go this way. However, I'm not going to go that way because I want to promote shalom. I want to be able to promote the higher values. So all of this is to say that from a Jewish law perspective, our preference is for settlement. And that's the way Beit Din today really functions. However, Yechiel, I see your hand, but I'm going to actually go through the arbitrator question first, please. The arbitrator poses a unique problem. There are many models of alternative dispute resolution. You have negotiation, where the parties work out their problems themselves. Wouldn't it be wonderful if all cases could just be resolved that way? You have mediation, where the parties have a selected intermediary, but they're coming up with the solution, much better than litigation. everything is kept private. Everything can hopefully be handled between them. The advantage over negotiation is that you have a professional involved to help. You have conciliation, which is like mediation, but the intermediary actually suggests a solution. And then you have arbitration, which is really the most like litigation. You can have an individual arbitrator, you can have a panel of arbitrators, and they hear the arguments and they propose a solution, which is then binding on the participants. Yes, there's binding arbitration, there's non-binding arbitration, but I'm not going into MedArb, mediation arbitration. We don't really need to get into that level of detail. But what happens if they're going to go with arbitration? And the arbitrator is going to adopt a system of law, like will happen under family law in Canada. They're going to go with a system of law that is not consistent with halacha, with Jewish law. You're going to be dividing up property, right? This goes back to our vignette. You're going to be dividing up property on the basis of principles that Jewish law would not necessarily go with. So we have a prohibition in Judaism against litigating in court other than in a Beit Din. And if you look at source number 22, I gave you a link there for my session in 2017 on litigating in civil court. And it's a big, big topic, and we're just going to get a slice of it here. In Judaism, as was true historically in general society, justice and courts were about enforcing divine ideals in society. It wasn't about enforcing a set of laws that the community agreed upon. It was saying justice is a religious act, and certainly true in Judaism. Contemporary Canada, like most of the world, has largely moved away from that model to a model where we're talking about swift justice for all citizens determined by the citizens themselves. That's the system. But Judaism continues to insist on a religious concept of law. So that going to a secular court, if you take a look at source number 23, is considered an insult to divine honor, right? You're abandoning God's system of justice for some other system. Number two, it undermines the Jewish law system. Who's going to bother to learn our laws and our Torah in the event that they can go to a secular system? And number three, law is viewed as a mitzvah. It's a religious responsibility. The Talmud has all sorts of statements about how a person who engages in justice through the court systems is a partner with God in creating the world. It's a religious act. So if I'm going to go to an arbitrator, I'm going to somebody who is going to decide the case via a system of laws that is other than the Torah system of laws, I may have a problem. You know, Yechiel noted to me before the session, if you take a look at source number 24 on the sheet from the Arbitration Act, the Lieutenant Governor and Council may make regulations requiring that every arbitrator who conducts a family arbitration be a member of a specified dispute resolution organization or of a specified class of members of the organization. You need to be on the government-approved list. So that's number one. Now, nothing stops a rabbi from getting that training. However, look what comes next here from that same rule. They also make regulations requiring any arbitrator who conducts a family arbitration to have received training approved by the Attorney General. That includes training and screening parties for power imbalances and domestic violence. Right, that's actually not the issue. That also they could do. The issue is what I had said earlier, which is that you have to follow, for family law, you have to follow the procedures and principles set up by the laws of Ontario and Canada. And those are not going to be consistent with the Torah's principles. So are you now going to a secular court? So there's a lot to discuss on this issue, and some of it is going to be continued in vignette 3. I will note for you Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz in source number 25, the Chazon Ish, who I mentioned earlier. And he says, you can go to an arbitrator who is not going to use Jewish law in order to come up with a solution. That's okay. As long as you're going to the arbitrator as an individual you trust, not as a representative of a separate legal system. The arbitrator can use whatever principles the arbitrator wants. But as long as you're going to the arbitrator for some kind of pshara, some kind of of settlement and you're not adopting formal rules, that would not be a violation of the principle against litigating in a court other than a rabbinical court. But it's a little tricky to apply that Chazon Ish to our discussion, because here, really, you know, the arbitrator is required to follow the laws of Canada. That's, by definition, what underlies the authority of the arbitrator. So I think it may be difficult to do that. What I would suggest, and this is something that was alluded to before, would be for the parties involved, or the party who's, you know, trying to pursue it, in this case maybe Sarah, to get what's called a heter erka'ot. A heter erka'ot is permission by the Beth Din to be able to go to civil court in order to have the case heard. And that may be a way to deal with this problem, not unlike what Yechiel was talking about earlier in terms of getting a rabbi to sign off beforehand. It's not entirely clear to me that this is necessary in this case, because you don't have the option of going to a rabbinical court and getting an enforceable agreement. But I think it's probably the wisest path for one to choose. There's a lot more to be said about this issue, but it's 10:42 and we only have 18 minutes, and I did want to get to vignette number 3 in less time than it takes to make matzah. But I saw before, Yechiel had his hand up and Miriam has her hand up now. I'm going to take Yechiel and Miriam, and then we'll go to vignette number 3. Yes, Yechiel.
It's not bad if you go a few minutes past 11 with the rabbi this time. I just wanted to emphasize, and indeed after you first recognized me and told me to shut still for a minute, you did cover some of it, but we must differentiate, particularly in Ontario, between arbitration and mediation.
Mm-hmm.
Mediator helps the parties come to their own agreement with
right.
whatever system of law or whatever they want to use. That's
right.
fine. The arbitrator imposes a solution, and it's the arbitration under Canadian Ontario law that has to take place, not under Jewish law.
Correct. Correct. Yeah, no, that's why I made the vignette with arbitration specifically. Thank you. Miriam.
So, very humbly, just to say, the concept that we can't go to a secular law because it shows that we're questioning the Torah law, isn't there something, a weakness in the Torah law as it's been evolved through whatever, through the Torah Sheva'al Peh? Aren't we seeing that there really is a weakness here, that we actually need to rely on the secular, which means that the system didn't think enough about the needs of women at the time, and that there is something that we, at least in the modern age, would see as a flaw that we need to turn to another authority for?
Right. So there are two possibilities here. I hear what you're asking, but there are two possibilities. Possibility number one is that you're going to the secular system because the government has said you're not allowed to do this yourself. And in that case, no, it's not a reflection of frustration with the Jewish system. It's, I live in a country where that's the law. And that's what we're talking about here. Separate possibility is, I don't want to go to rabbinical court because I don't like their principles for the distribution of property, and therefore I want to go to the secular one. And my answer to that is that was foreseen 2,000 years ago. Hang in there, and in vignette number 3, we're going to address that, as you'll see in a moment. So, but the case here is not, we're going to secular court because we really like their system. It's the law on the books says I have to. So, or I have to if I want an enforceable agreement, I should say. They're fine with two parties coming up with whatever decision they want. They're not fine with the parties with one of the parties then trying to enforce it with the other. Okay, let's go to vignette 3, because this is really important and carries a lot of weight in terms of this. And I'm sorry we're not going to get to 4 and 5. Yechiel, I don't like going over time. I respect people's time. I tell people an hour and a half, it's an hour and a half. So, vignette number 3, if you go back to the beginning of the source sheet. Recognizing Abe's resistance to arbitration, Sarah proposes mediation, which Abe accepts. During a mediation session, Abe warns that if he does not get his way and Sarah accepts funds that Jewish law would not assign to her, she will be guilty of theft in the eyes of Jewish law. Sarah argues that Judaism's respect for the law of the land means she should be able to claim property as assigned by the law. Which of them is correct? Is Sarah allowed to profit from this mediation in ways that Jewish law would not have given to her? So first of all, and Miriam, this speaks to your point. In terms of Abe's insistence on following the halachic system for distributing property, it's important to recognize we have always had workarounds for the halachic system of distributing property. If you take a look at source number 26 on your sheet, there is a link for a class I gave on the ketubah in court, and there you can learn more about this. But there have been always been ways for women to protect themselves and their property. So as an example of this, there was something called siluk. What siluk means, if you take a look at source number 27 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, if a man writes the following, or he says to his wife, while they are in erusin, in kiddushin, before they've gotten fully married, I have no claim upon your property, then if she sells or gives away the property, that's valid. This is a passage from the Talmud that is enshrined in Jewish law. But the Talmud is ksuvo staf pe gimel. A man is able to disclaim any share in her property, and that is effective. It can be done before the marriage, it can be done during the marriage. There's some discussion as to which property will come under it if it's done before property is acquired. But the point is, you have a very above board method of handling things. There is also the below board method of handling things, in which a woman would do what was called havracha. And what that means is, a woman before the marriage would say to a trusted friend or to a relative, I want to give you all of my property, knowing full well that this is artificial and that what's going to happen is if the marriage ends, she's going to claim the property back. So this is not a nice thing to do because you're cheating the system. You're pretending to give it away when you didn't give it away. However, the Code of Jewish Law says, yeah, but it works. If you take a look at source number 28, from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, if a woman writes all of her property to another, whether it's a relative or not, before she marries, then even though the gift would be canceled, if she were to be widowed or divorced, she would go back on the gift. Still, the husband may not eat the fruits of that property. He does not inherit it from her if she predeceases him. She gave it away before they married. So what you see here is, this absolutely exists within Jewish law. The ability to deal with circumstances if you don't like the way that Jewish law would carry it out. Having said that, I do want to note for you a very interesting debate. I didn't bring it on the source sheet, but there was a very interesting debate in the journal Tchumen, volumes 18 and 19, between Rabbi Shlomo Dakovsky and Rabbi Avram Sherman about equitable distribution as a halachic principle. Because in the Tnaim document I mentioned beforehand, which the families of the two parties agree to before they ever get married, it says, Yishlatu b'nechseihon, they will control their property, shave b'shave, equally. They're going to handle their property equally. So there's great debate as to whether that's just a nice sentiment or whether that has legal force. But that's a great debate about equitable distribution in terms of Jewish law that I think is worth knowing about. Again, we don't have the time in this session to be able to go into that in depth, but if you go to my ketubah class in source number 29, I think I may have dealt with it in that session. But let's speak to Abe's claim. Abe says that if Sarah accepts funds assigned to her by the civil court that Jewish law would not assign, that is theft. Abe is not making this up. This is an old issue. It's an old principle. I brought you Rabbi Akiva Eger in source number 33 who said so. Oh, you know what? Sorry, it's not in 33 on your sheet. This is one of the sources that I added that are only going to be on the sheet I send out tonight. Rabbi Akiva Eger says, if one transfers money via secular court, if the Jewish law would be different, this money is theft in his possession. So that may apply regarding division of assets from the marriage. However, there are three reasons to argue that Sarah can accept the money. Reason number one is, maybe you could argue, as Sarah wants to argue in the vignette, the law of the land is the law, and that should be binding upon us. It is a passage in the Talmud, Bava Kama Kuf Yud Gimel, that says, Dina de Machusa Dina, the law of the land is the law. So maybe that means that this should be binding. Well, you could argue against that, By quoting Rabbi Moshe Sofer in source number 29, he's not dealing with a family property situation, I think. It sort of is. He's dealing with an inheritance case. But he says, what do you mean the law of the land is the law? The line is the law of the empire, the law of the government, the law of the monarchy in his case, is the law. And he says the monarch doesn't care about issues between two Jews as long as they get paid. As long as the government gets paid, they don't care how you're dividing up your property and who's inheriting what. They want their estate tax, and then you can do whatever you like with it. So he says that this is not, you can't make that argument. However, the scope of this principle that the law of the land is the law may include laws that benefit society as a whole, even where they don't affect the government directly. So I brought you Rabbi Yosef Kolon in source number 30, the Maharik. He says, it is possible to say the government law is the law, for the king says his land may be acquired with a designated document. You know, I don't want to go into this too much because it's getting late, this particular source. But essentially what he argues is that what he argues is that government benefits when the population is doing well. And therefore, you can make the argument that the government wants that which helps the population as a whole, which may include rules for the distribution of property in family law cases. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, in source number 31, said, we do not recognize government law other than in matters that benefit the king or that benefit the citizenry. So you could argue that in our case, it benefits the citizenry to have equitable distribution of the property from the marriage. That's one argument that Sarah is trying to make here, such that she should be able to, receive what the court assigns. That's number one. Number two, and this is something that will be on the source sheet that I send out tonight, Rabbi Mordechai Willig of the Beth Din of America wrote an article in 2014 called Retaining the Proceeds of Secular Court Judgments, in which he noted that even though I mentioned already from Rabbi Akiva Eger that there's resistance to accepting assets assigned by the secular court, nonetheless, popular practice is to accept those funds, to accept the money. So how do you deal with that? So he provided an interesting idea based on an early writer called the Or Zarua. The Or Zarua points out there is a biblical commandment for the secular society to develop laws and to develop courts. They have a mitzvah. And the Or Zarua says that since what they're doing is a mitzvah, setting up their laws, setting up their courts, it's valid for us as well. The reason we don't go to their courts is because we have this separate rule of you should be going to rabbinical courts. But that doesn't mean that their system is no good to us. So if somebody ends up in a secular court, it is going to be binding. They're practicing a mitzvah. I'm going to quote to you from Rabbi Willig's article itself. He says, if both parties agreed to be judged in secular court and the court decided in accordance with Jewish law, the decision is binding. Meaning if their decision matches Jewish law, the decision is binding. Even though the parties violated the prohibition against going to secular court, post facto the decision stands since the law of the land is the law. This ruling of the Or Zarua establishes an important principle. The judgment of a secular court can, in limited respects, achieve halachic legitimacy. To be sure, Jews are ordinarily prohibited from litigating in secular courts. But those same courts play a Torah-mandated role in society, and halacha does not necessarily disregard the outcomes of secular court proceedings. So that's a second reason why she may be able to keep the money. Third argument from Michael Broyd, who helped me a lot in finding materials to address this issue. The third argument is, when the husband and wife enter the marriage, it is with the understanding that that's how property will be distributed in the event that, God forbid, the marriage breaks up. It's what he calls minag sochrim. This is the way business is done. I mentioned in the beginning of the session, or towards the beginning of the session, a back and forth between Rabbi Broid and Rabbi Chaim Malinovitz regarding the 1992 GET law in New York. And as part of the back and forth, Rabbi Broid said the following, and this will be on the source sheet that I send out tonight. Rabbi Broid writes, "The scope of the halachic duty to follow the law of the land, or the ability of the Jewish community to incorporate the law of the land into Jewish financial dealings through common commercial custom, this minag sochrim, remains one of the fundamental issues in the whole discussion of the get law. I believe that the custom of the Orthodox Jewish community, or vast portions of it, is to accept as part of our customary financial law the concept of alimony, post-divorce payments, and very likely equitable distribution." He says, "Indeed, for the last number of years, at every wedding where I am invited to sit at the groom's table, the chasan's ditch, while the ksuba is signed, I ask the husband whether, if the marriage were to end by divorce, does he expect to pay his wife the value of the ktuba and return to her the assets that she brought to the marriage, or does the couple expect some other form of asset division in cases of divorce?" Rabbi Broid was actually at my wedding in 1997, the year he wrote this article. I don't remember him asking me this, but honestly, it's been a lot of years, so maybe he did. But he says, I'm almost always told by the husband and wife they do not intend for the ketubah to control the division of assets. That really is the intent of many couples. This fact is reflected in the American custom of not negotiating the dollar amounts in the ketubah. Right? We don't sit there and change the numbers in the ketubah at all. That was done centuries ago. It's not the practice among Ashkenazim, certainly, in the U.S. and Canada. So you have three reasons to argue it's not theft for her to accept this payment. Number one, maybe you could argue the law of the land is the law, and there, because this is for the benefit of society as a whole. That's number one. Number two, you might be able to argue, as Rabbi Willig notes, that the courts are practicing a mitzvah, and what they do is valid, even if one shouldn't have gone to secular court. Or number three, this is the mindset of people who get married, that that's the way they're going to deal with their assets in the event that the marriage ends. Frankly, it will be best to have an explicit prenuptial agreement, as advised before, in which they agree that they're going to work with the secular distribution of assets, and then you will not have a problem. You might benefit also, as I said before, from a heter erkos, a license from a rabbinical court to go to secular court. I'm not 100% sure that will be needed here where you don't have alternatives, but that's the answer to vignette 3. We did not get to the issue of vignette 4, turning to secular courts, or a secular system to get the settlement payment back from a spouse. That's, you can look at what I brought you in source 33 where there's information on that. And we did not deal with the issue as well of access and custody, for which I gave you several sources, but that's also something. Maybe next year we'll do a family law part 2 and we'll deal with those and other issues because there's so much more obviously to discuss. Please remember, if you did not sign in yet in the chat, you must sign in order to be able to get credit for having been here. So if you have not yet signed in, please, please, please make sure that you do so. Thank you very, very much. Our next session is in March.
Thank you very much.
If anyone has comments or questions that they want to ask me, I didn't mean to shut everybody down. I'm willing to stick around. That was kind of an abrupt ending there.
It's okay. I'm going to try and send you that information.
Please do.
I just want to double check with him because I just want to make sure he's still active.
Okay. Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Bye. Thank you.
Okay. Questions and comments? Yes, Yechiel.
Professor Arkavot.
Yes. Yes.
Can one get such a hefer